Michael Slide, I apologize.
I'd like to welcome you today. I'm David Gruske, and this is the first debate in a series of four debates that are part of our Controversies About Inequality debate series. And this debate's financed by the Elfinworks Foundation, by the Stanford Center on Ethics, by the Haas Center for Public Service, and by the Department of Medicine here at Stanford University. And the topic of today's debate is why health outcomes are associated with income and other measures of one's social position. Although we take it for granted and have become inured to it, on the face of it, it would seem extraordinary in light of our egalitarian sensibilities that life itself is in part meted out by one's position in the social hierarchy. And we'll be trying to make sense of that association here today. So let me turn to the introductions. We're very fortunate to have with us here today Sir Michael Marmot, who was knighted in 2000 by the Queen of England for services in epidemiology and health inequalities. He's winner of the Balzan Prize for outstanding achievements in epidemiology in 2004, and more generally, he's the figure that established the field of health inequalities, an immensely influential field today, and little more need be said. Likewise, we're very fortunate to have with us here today Ray Catalano, professor of public health at that other Bay Area university, UC Berkeley. His research is wide-ranging and very influential, but perhaps among the general public, he's best known for showing how it is that the social world affects various types of health outcomes, how it is that say 9/11 affects health outcomes, or how it is that economic growth affects health outcomes. The title of one of his recent papers is If Economic Expansion Threatens Public Health, Should Epidemiologists Recommend Recession? It's a real honor to have with us here today both Sir Michael Marmot and Ray Catalano. So this is what we're going to do. We'll start off with a 20-minute statement by Sir Michael Marmot, followed by an equivalent 20-minute statement by Professor Catalano. Each of them will then have an opportunity for 5-minute rebuttals, and then we'll just turn to questions from the audience. So welcome to Sir Michael Marmot.
Well, thank you very much. We may find this is a debate where both sides agree, but that's no bad thing. I'm going to ask the question, why is there a social gradient in health? And let me just say what I mean by the gradient. You will have seen this slide yesterday, and if you come to my lecture tomorrow, you'll see it again tomorrow. And if you come to the one I'm going to give on Friday, you'd see it again on Friday. From our Whitehall study of British civil servants, it's very important, I think, because British civil servants exclude the richest people in society, and they exclude the poorest people in society. These are all people in white-collar jobs, in stable employment. My subscription is about to expire. I won't get next month's New Yorker. Oh dear, what did I do? Oh dear. Oh, my subscription.
The audience will direct us here.
As somebody said to me, every family needs one techie, and ours is my 16-year-old daughter, but she's not with me, so I don't know what to do when you get a message. You know, normally I call her and say, what do I do next? She set up my BlackBerry so it could communicate with her BlackBerry, and when she did this, I sent her a message. But then it showed up in my inbox, and I couldn't quite. And I said, did I send you a message, or did I send me a message? And I got back, you sent me a message. Well done, Daddy. That doesn't count in my 20 minutes. if you're trying to understand inequalities in health and you focus only on the health of the worst off, the poor, it's quite a different challenge than if you're trying to understand the gradient in people who are not poor. So that's what we're seeking to understand. And the gradient continues to the oldest age. I showed you mortality a moment ago. This is self-reported physical health in older people by grade of employment from the Whitehall 2 study. And you can see that, this may renew the subscription, you can see that the high grades have the onset of physical decline several years later than the low grades. In fact, we calculated that a 72-year-old high-grade man is equivalent to a 60-year-old low-grade man in terms of physical health. So it's not just mortality, it's morbidity. Even in egalitarian Sweden, we see the social gradient. This is from a follow-up to the 1990 census. And you can see that people with a doctorate have lower mortality than those with a master's degree or a professional qualification. I would say anybody in the room who doesn't have a doctorate, you should stop listening to this debate and get working, because it's a matter of life and death. Those with lower tertiary, bachelor's degree, higher, etc., all the way down. And if you're thinking about poverty, why would people with a PhD have lower mortality than those with a professional degree who probably have higher income? So it's not just people at the bottom, it's the whole of society. And right at the very top, I've pointed to this before, Oscar winners have life expectancy 4 years longer than people who were nominated and didn't win. And I say, because we calculated in Britain that if you abolished heart disease completely, you'd add about 3.6 years to life expectancy. A four-year difference is equivalent to reducing your chance of dying from a heart attack from average to zero. So it's enormous. So we see this social gradient right across the whole of society. So what do I think about poverty? Well, the most exquisite measure of poverty is infant mortality. In most people's view, including my own, Australian Aboriginals would be poor. And yet, you can see their life expectancy is 17 years shorter for men and for women than for non-Indigenous Australians. So that would be consistent with poverty having a dramatic effect on health. Australian Aboriginals living in one of the richest countries in the world have shorter life expectancy than the average in India. And look at Russia. Men in Russia, shorter life expectancy than India. Now, having said that infant mortality is the most exquisite indicator, if we put infant mortality on a scale from 3 in Iceland to 181 in Sierra Leone, Australian Aboriginals look much more like Iceland than they do like Sierra Leone. It's not infant mortality that accounts for that 17 years fewer life expectancy. It's adult mortality, it's cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, gastrointestinal disease, metabolic and endocrine disorders, cancers, and accidental and violent deaths. And we do not think that these are related to material deprivation, which is the way we usually think about poverty. So we need to think about poverty in terms other than material deprivation. And you can see that amongst the richer countries, there's really no relation between income of a country and life expectancy. Greece here, for example, with gross domestic product at purchasing power parities of $22,000, has longer life expectancy than the US, which has nearly double the income. And that's really rather interesting, because if you take people within the US who have a household income of $22,000 and compare them with those that have an income of 40,000, they probably have nearly twice the mortality rate. And yet that level of income, national income, seems to make no difference at all. So what's going on? I think income is a guide to relative position in the hierarchy. It's not the absolute level of income that matters insofar as that relates to material deprivation. It's very much more related to what income tells you about where you are in the hierarchy. And from the Whitehall 2 study, looking at the relation between income and poor self-rated health, you can see an odds ratio of 2 for poor self-rated health, just adjusted for age, between people at the bottom of the income scale and those at the top. When we adjust for age and baseline health, it goes down to about 1.6. And when we adjust for a number of other measures, including grade of employment, then there's no relation between income and poor health. There is, however, a continuing relation with wealth. Not income, but wealth. And the same is true for women. And in fact, when we've looked at what might be underlying this relation with wealth, which is economic difficulties, people who are wealthier are less likely to have economic difficulties, then we find that in relation to coronary events, people with economic difficulties, adjusting for age, are 2.8 times more likely to have coronary events. Adjusting for other measures of socioeconomic position makes very little difference. Adjusting for early life factors, work characteristics, and so on, it's still 2.3 times more likely those with economic difficulties to have acute coronary events. So I think what wealth does is protect people from bad things in their lives, which, if you like, is a measure of psychosocial factors. So it's not just income, but what your social position means in your life. Now, the social gradient is not inevitable. This is life expectancy at birth for men by social class in England and Wales, comparing the early 90s with the late 90s. And you can see for class one, the top class, life expectancy improved by 6.5 years, and it improved by 4.6 years for those at the bottom. So it improved right across the board, but improved more if you're already high status. So the magnitude of the inequalities got bigger. So it's not fixed. It can get bigger. And the same thing happened in the US. I won't go into it now, but the black-white differences increased. And within Russia, once again, we found an increasing difference between those with university education and those with elementary education. So the social gradient can get bigger. It's not inevitable. What about selection? The selection argument is, and in my experience, whenever I've talked about this subject, which I have once or twice a week, over the last many years, I can, as a perfect diagnostic test, I haven't quite done sensitivity and specificity, but an almost perfect diagnostic test, if somebody says, have you thought of the possibility that health determines social position, I can say, you're an economist, aren't you? And he says, how did you know that? Can just tell. In fact, I gave a lecture once to a group of Chicago economists, which is not a pleasant experience. And I said, I'd like you to make two assumptions. I showed the Whitehall gradient. I said, I'd like you to make two assumptions. The first is that when it occurs to you to ask, have I thought of the possibility that health determines social position? The answer is yes, I have. And the second assumption, which I'll ask you to hang on to for 40 minutes, is that I can give you a convincing account in favor of my position You can drop that assumption. But what I don't want you to do is spend the whole lecture thinking, has he thought of the fact that this is all endogenous? I have thought about it. I've even got some data. And let me just show you very quickly. This is employment grade and a measure of health at phase three of the Whitehall 2 study. This is looking at physical health determining employment grade and employment grade determining physical health, accounting for the baseline correlation between them. And the pathway from grade to health is six times as strong as the pathway from health to employment grade. There are data from birth cohort studies looking at health in childhood. And for example, from the 1958 birth cohort, the correlation between adult social class and adult health reduced when adjusting for educational qualifications. Adolescent health did not contribute to reducing the social gradient in adult health. So there are a number of arguments, and I won't say more about it now. But one is that if you think that health might determine social position within a population, how do we account for the fact that things get worse for whole populations? This is what happened in Russia with the collapse of the Soviet Union and this dramatic decline in life expectancy. Now, I think, and I've got evidence to support it, that some of the health disadvantage of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union is related to the same set of influences that are responsible for the social gradient. If health gets dramatically worse so quickly, it seems to me inherently extremely unlikely that worsening health caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. Far more plausible is that the collapse of Soviet society led to this dramatic plunge in life expectancy. And similarly, I don't think that the improved health it caused the ruble crisis, it just doesn't fit. With the ruble crisis, health dropped. Causal pathways, and given the time, I'm not going to go into these in detail, but we have evidence for all of these, that it starts early in life, there are important behaviours that play a part in the pathway, but only a part, and showing that it's only a part. This is from the first Whitehall study, the social gradient in heart disease mortality, and then the social gradient adjusted for smoking, systolic blood pressure, plasma cholesterol height, and blood sugar, and it accounts for between a quarter and a third of the social gradient. So these risk factors are important, but they're only part of the story. Medical care. Robert Sapolsky and I have spent the morning working on a paper that we've worked on nearly daily for the last 2 years, nearly daily. But one of the arguments about the usual explanations is we see a social gradient in non-human primates, all of whom get rather poor medical care, none of whom reads the New York Times to find out what the latest explanation is. This is from the rhesus macaque studies at Bowman Gray. Females get less atherosclerosis than males. If you take out a female's ovaries, she gets as much atherosclerosis as a male. If, like me, you went into public health because you didn't want to be a surgeon, then the other way of doing it, instead of taking out her ovaries, is to make her subordinate. And she gets nearly as much atherosclerosis as if you took out her ovaries. So the social gradient you see in non-human primates can't easily be accounted for by behaviours, medical care, etc. I think how much control people have over their lives is rather crucial. From the Whitehall 2 study, this is looking at job control. People with low job control have higher incidence of coronary disease than those with high job control. We've accounted here for effort-reward imbalance, because imbalance between effort and reward on the job is also a predictor of coronary disease. And here we've adjusted for coronary risk factors and negative affect. But low control, very important. And looking at our work factors as a whole, This is the model of high demand, low control, low support, effort-reward imbalance, low justice at work, and combining them. And we're looking at the population attributable risk for coronary heart disease. In other words, what proportion of all the coronary events that occur in this working age population could be attributed to these three psychosocial factors at work. And the answer is, adjusting for other predictors, 29% of the coronary events that occur could be attributed to these psychosocial working conditions. And in general, these get worse as you go down the hierarchy. There's a huge literature on social supports and the fact that people with high degrees of social supports are protected from illness. And biological underpinning, which is part of the whole argument, that we're actually dealing with causal pathways here. This is from the Whitehall 2 study looking at the metabolic syndrome, central adiposity, disturbance of blood chemistry. And the metabolic syndrome is a risk factor for diabetes and coronary disease. And we looked at isostrain, which is high demand, low control, low support in the workplace. And because Whitehall 2 is a longitudinal study, we asked, did they have no exposure to isostrain, 1, 2, 3 or more exposures? And the more exposures to stress at work, the greater the prevalence of the metabolic syndrome. So it's a plausible mechanism of low social status, more job stress, more metabolic syndrome, more diabetes and heart disease is the sort of causal pathway. And the potential mechanisms, the stress pathways, the two major axes, the HPA axis and the sympathetic-parasympathetic axis, from Robert Sapolsky and colleagues, looking at the social gradient in cortisol by social stressors in primates. And one of the points that Sapolsky and his colleagues make is that not all primates are the same. There are 150 different primate species, and this is looking at 10 different species and classifying them by the degree to which subordinates are exposed to bad things. So if you're in a species where being low status means that you can be dumped on by the high status animal, then your cortisol level is likely to be much higher if you're low status than high status. If it's relatively benign and being low status does not imply that the high status animals do bad things to you, then the difference in cortisol level between the low and high status is much less. So it's consistent with saying we've got a pathway here. And we've seen similar things in the Whitehall 2 study. This is looking at heart rate variability, which is a measure of sympathetic-parasympathetic balance and the metabolic syndrome. And what we find is those with the lowest heart rate variability are more likely to have the metabolic syndrome. And low heart rate variability is thought to be a bad thing. It's more of the sympathetic and less of the parasympathetic. So it's a plausible biological mechanism. And I think all this matters because we can do something about it. And I will talk sometime tomorrow, I think, at Grand Rounds about the Commission on Social Determinants of Health and how we can put some of this into action. Thank you.
I'll have to tell my wife and daughter that they were on the wall here at Stanford. Let me start by telling you that today has been a most extraordinary day for me. It started when I woke up and after a very busy weekend of traveling, and I realized that today I was debating Sir Michael Marmot, the most distinguished graduate of our program at Berkeley. I had to say that, Michael, because we're here at Stanford. It's never a good day when you're going to debate Michael Marmot, because after all, Michael Marmot, for most of us, stands for someone who asks us to be just, asks us to be fair, asks us to understand how what we do collectively affects the least among us. Now, how would you like to be the con person in a debate with someone who's making that case? I realize my ambition got ahead of my judgment. What made the day yet worse for me was that when I arrived here at Stanford expecting to find that Professor Grusky would be the Professor Grusky I worked with in my career, who's at UCLA, to discover it's Professor Grusky's son who invited me here today, making me feel not only foolish but much older than I thought I was. So I will do my best to make a debate out of this. I want to say at the outset that there are very few people in the field who I admire more than Michael Marmot for his work and his advocacy. So this is not this is something I do with considerable trepidation, but I'm going to do it in the spirit of our academic lives. I came here thinking most of you would be sociologists. Now I understand that's probably not the case, but for those of you who are, let me give you a little insight into what I'm trying to do here with the very little sociologic knowledge that I have. The one thing that stuck with me in those years that I was the associate editor for Health and Social Behavior was that sociologists are interested in manifest and latent functions of things that we do in public and organizations that we create and crusades that we start. And Sir Michael is the probably the most effective presenter of the manifest narrative, the manifest story, for those of us who would like to see the world to be a place that's more concerned about the health effects of what we do collectively. The manifest argument is the best argument, the argument that we're all well motivated, that everything we do is our sincere attempt to give you all the information that we have, the best science, and that our position is based on our science. Those of us who know anything about sociology know there's also a latent function to what we're doing. And the latent function often includes those things we'd rather not tell the audience, those things that we're not necessarily so proud of in a movement or an organization, but are in fact very much a part of what we do. And to not know those would lead the student, for example, to misunderstand the enterprise. And if the enterprise that we're here to discuss today, and I don't want to use the term debate, but the enterprise we're here to discuss today is the enterprise of those of us who want to make the world more interested in, if not concerned about, and caring of those who, by virtue of our hierarchy, seem to bear an unusually high fraction of the costs of what we do. So I'm here to give you the kind of latent narrative for that effort. Before I do it, I want to thank Professor Grusky for inviting me, and hope he tells his dad I said hello. I want to thank Beth Anderson, Tim Bruckner, Sidra Goldman, George Kaplan, Kat Saxton, Mina Sabaraman, and Len Syme for their advice and their willingness to listen to me give little pieces of this. I want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for supporting them. When they sat and listened to me, they wouldn't have done it otherwise. But I also want to be very careful to say that none of them have approved what I said today, and had they known what I was going to say today, they probably would not want their name on the slide. So they are not part of the argument. Okay, I have to do something that I hate sitting in the audience and listening to other people do, which is to tell you a story and to use up a big chunk of my 20 minutes. But I'm afraid if you don't know the latent narrative of this whole enterprise, you won't understand why Michael and I are here, or why we on occasions disagree. Not that he worries about my disagreeing with him, but we do occasionally disagree. Okay. And so let me tell you the story. There's a story that goes something like this. That Professor Sapolsky's here today, I understand. Yeah, okay, so I had to put this in because I knew he'd be here. I thought he'd be here. Now, there's an argument that goes something like this, that natural selection has conserved individuals in many species as sort of containers to move genes from one time to another time, that one of the reasons that individuals work pretty well in this enterprise, at least they haven't been replaced, is that you can endow them with this behavior in which they avoid pain and they avoid death and they kind of seek pleasure, and as a result of that they are pretty effective movers in time of genes because they'll want to create more genes by virtue of the pleasure of having kids and the pleasure of reproduction, and they'll want to avoid the pain of death and the pain of extinction, and so they'll make pretty good containers. It's the case though that in order to get on with this job of keeping themselves relatively at low risk of pain and high risk of pleasure, that what they'll do is organize to further the mission, because you can do a lot more as a team than you can do individually, or at least that's the story. But these organizations are often hierarchical. That is, in order to get on with the job, you create a kind of organization in which some at the top seem to have more of the benefit from this organization and perhaps
less of the pain than others, but the argument is by sort of that assignment, you get on with all of us doing, on the aggregate, less work, and you sort of move ahead, even though you have this lousy assignment, relatively speaking, these distributional effects. Those at the top have more autonomy, resources, and pleasure, so the story goes. Now, humans, when they do this, there's a facet of their organization we call the economy. It's not the entire organization of how humans get on with the job of being human, but it's part of it, because from these economies, we supposedly get the goods and services that are presumed to make us happier, which is what we do as these individuals. Humans, however, have a lot of culture. By culture, we mean humans have all these things that we do for lots of reasons, but among them is to ameliorate this maldistribution of costs and benefits. We try to overcome the fact that some among us seem to pay a higher price than the rest. We have all kinds of mechanisms by which we try to undo or work against the cost of the hierarchy. Now, what we're about here today is this debate. There's an age-old debate among us in our species about whether we're doing enough with culture to overcome the adversity induced on some of us or inflicted on some of us by virtue of the hierarchy we create because we're human. Do we really have to have this maldistribution of cost? And can we undo it? Can we make it less? That's the debate. And there's some of us, some among us, who believe that we should be doing more, faster, to reduce the cost, and some say, no, you can't do it that fast. The reformers will argue that a good society would do more to reduce the inequalities and happiness that we now have. And among those reformers are those who are trained in epidemiology, like Sir Michael and I. And we argue that happiness arises from health, that the abstraction of happiness takes on some meaning when we talk about health, and that therefore there's a gradient of health that reflects the gradient of happiness that reflects this kind of organization of humans, which seems to be arising out of the selection of individuals to carry on genes. But as Sir Michael said, and I agree, we should use a lot of culture to overcome that kind of a biological imperative. The argument, of course, is, and you've already heard it referred to, that there's stress-induced. Stress is the perceived lack of resources and autonomy to deal with the demands on us. And as you go down the hierarchy, we have more stress because we have less autonomy and less resources to deal with the demands of the whatever function we provide in that organization. This causes endocrinal changes, and those lead to illness. And that's the kind of general story and metaphor that you hear in this field. And because of the fact that that mechanism tends to create a hierarchy of illness, then a good society would be one that uses its culture to mitigate those effects. And therefore, health, good health, should be indicative of a good society. That's the narrative. There are others, and I'll use the term others because it avoids me taking responsibility, but the others, for the most part, are economists. And as Michael has already said, you know, you talk to an economist about this and they have a very different view. And the view goes something like this. You know, the problem is you can do a lot to mitigate the effects of our organization on those as you move down the hierarchy, but every time you do that, you create a circumstance where the overall organization, which of course exists to try to produce things at the average lowest cost, the average lowest effort, every time you do that, you make that system a little less efficient. And so therefore, by helping those at the bottom, always trying to help those at the bottom, you may be in fact jeopardizing the health of the whole. So the whole may be less healthy than it should be, and therefore in some utilitarian calculation, on average, while you may have helped some among us, you in fact kept us all down, and if you could do the math, you'd probably find out that we're actually worse off by virtue of this little intervention you wanted to. Because all of us suffer by this attempt to help those farther down. That's the classic economist argument. It's called moral hazard. It has all these kinds of in and outs. Any economists in the room? Nobody from Hoover came over for this today? God, I'm disappointed. Okay, so the argument goes that things like moral hazard and reservation wage, all these kind of distortions that get introduced into our organization by trying too hard to help those at the bottom. Now, the reformers, of course, hear this argument. What they don't like about this argument is that it implies that everybody in the hierarchy gets sicker by trying to invest too heavily in the bottom. So they want to come up, meaning us, I'll say they in the case of, it sounds like a real debate, right? They, Sir Michael, wants us, wants to have a counter-argument, which argues that, in fact, If you don't help those towards the bottom as you move down, all of us get sick anyway. And of course, that's the argument. That if you have this kind of distribution in the hierarchy, such that very little or relatively little is done to mitigate the stress as you move down, then it creates stress for all of us. And we all get sicker. And that's why the Whitehall gradient is so important to that argument, because it says if you're not at the top, if you're not at the very top, you might as well be at the bottom. Because the very richest is healthiest, and then somebody who's just a nickel less rich is sicker. And then a dime less sick is yet sicker. So if you're not at the very top, you might as well be at the bottom. Therefore, doing something for the people at the bottom is doing something for yourself, because if you're not at the top, you're at the bottom. That's the argument. That's the latent argument behind this. Okay? So, therefore, if you're a reformer like many of us are, you'll argue that giving the bottom more autonomy, political power, and resources currently monopolized by the top will make all of us healthier and therefore happier. Because we're all at the bottom if we're not at the top. People understand the narrative? I'm not asking to accept it. Well, there's a lot of stuff in that story, and a lot of that stuff then gets justified by what sounds like science. Now, Michael and I are not here today to debate science, because if we were, this would be a very different set of presentations, and there'd be much more agreement. But what this is really about, in the best sense of the word, is something better than science. This is about a conversation about what we should be doing collectively about our happiness and our health. And that's not always, in fact, maybe the most important times, not well informed by science, because it has to do with values and morality, things which are only indirectly, I would argue, influenced by empirical fact. But let's see now what we've said empirically about the circumstance in this narrative. My job is to introduce some skepticism here, okay? And I'll do my best, because I think good science proceeds only from skepticism, not from entire, you know, wholehearted belief and reification. So I'm going to try to answer some questions. What's the gradient? Where does it come from? What does it mean for our collective discussion over the good society? And is health ultimately the measure of a good society? And I have to do this quickly because I know I have less time. What's the gradient? The gradient is two points connected by lines that vary with outcome, time, and place. As an economist, I almost said two points connected by any line you want to draw, because that's an old, and among economists, that's an old joke about something called the Laffer curve, which is the relationship between taxes and productivity. Right? My point is a very simple one here. If you look at different outcomes in different places and at different times, the gradient is going to look very different. And I want you to be skeptical, because if you presume you're going to see the Whitehall gradient every place and time and for outcome you look, you're going to be mistaken. An audience in contemporary California, as we are, for example, could be misled, and I'm going to show you some data. This, by the way, is this is the gradient for mortality in the United States. Ignore the red line for the time being, because we probably won't get to it. Pay attention to the blue line and the confidence interval around it. These are data from the matched set of mortality data and census data in the U.S., I believe, for a 20-year period. So it's a big sample. It's probably the biggest sample you're going to get from the U.S. And what essentially it shows is, as you'd expect, if you're relatively poor, you're relatively more likely to die. The risk ratio is compared to those at the average, with those two lines, black lines cross. But you can see this doesn't look like Whitehall, nor should it, because Whitehall, of course, is stably employed persons who are relatively well-educated, and this is everyone. As you can see, the bottom 25% disproportionately are at great risk, a relatively great risk of death in this country. But when you get far out here, the confidence interval around that blue line is wide enough so you can go all the way back to about 100,000, and statistically they're not different. So it doesn't look Whitehall-like in general. Just so you're aware that, in fact, when you look at the population as a whole, at least in this country at this point in time, it doesn't look like what you'd expect if what you're carrying around in your head is the British Civil Service. Let's look at some California data. Sir Michael referred to infant mortality, which we believe is a widely respected indicator of population health, but I think we'd probably agree is much more complicated than people think. So let me give you some data here. Neonatal death rates, that means death rates in the first month of life. And I've got 2 years plotted there. I have 1994 in red and 2004 in green. And this is California. And I have it divided by people who have primary school up to completing primary school. And then people have some secondary school up to completing it. People have some high school up to completing it. And then some college up to completing it, or graduate school. And as you can see, in fact, in both years, the least educated among us, the lowest socioeconomic status, in fact, has probably the lowest neonatal mortality. That's place. Now, look at this in time. These are the same rates in time. Now, I wanted this chart to look confusing because it is. There are times here when the best educated have the worst rate outcomes, the least educated have the best, and there's movement all around, month by month. So if you're going to design a program for a certain place and a certain time and a certain outcome, if you walk into that job presuming the Whitehall gradient, you're going to make a mistake. I don't have time to explain this other than that these relationships are not hydraulic. It isn't the case that when one of these rates goes up, another goes down. The correlations among them are rather weak, suggesting that the causes are fairly diverse. Whoops. Okay. Did I go back? All right. Let me go back one. Oh, my gosh. Excuse me. These are post-neonatal death rates. These are death rates after the first month of life and through the rest of the first year of life. And you can see it's even more pronounced now. And for both of these times, the least well-educated have, in fact, the best outcomes. There's the movement in time. You can see it's very complicated, and you shouldn't make assumptions about them. If you were designing something for a particular point in time, correlations here are even smaller, none of them inverse. And then this is a more important slide. This may be the most important of the three from California that I have time to show you today. This is very low birth weight. Very low birth weight is thought to be important because many of the people who work on the social reform, the health part of the social reform movement, will argue that this is a terribly important criterion because low birth weight infants are at high risk of later morbidity and early mortality. And low birth weight, if you believe, for example, the Barker arguments and the fetal origin arguments, is in fact the antecedent of much of the pain and suffering we have in life, and it's a function of the gradients that parents and kids find themselves in. So if you look here, unlike many other places in the developed world, in fact, probably very few places in the developed world, it got worse in 2004 compared to 1994, and the only folks who improved were the least among us. And they have the best rates. That's the time variation. You can see it's all over the place, but the poor, the least educated, I should say, in fact, for the most part, are doing better than everyone else. Correlations here, at least we see a couple of negative ones, but they're not significant. In other words, there may be some trade-off, but it's not significant. Okay, where do the gradients come from? Now, my first argument is that which Michael's made, and I agree with him entirely. Part of the gradient is induced by social causation. That is, persons least able to shelter themselves against pathogens, least able to marshal the resources to cope with those pathogens, and whose contributions society values least, for the sociologists among you, will most frequently be ill. That is, that the poor are sicker than the rich. Where Michael and I probably disagree the most, and it's because I'm an economist, I'll have to admit, is that, you know, I don't think we can so quickly dispel selection. One of the reasons I argue that is because common sense in the developed world has created huge programs to take money from those of us who have it and give it to families who have children who are disabled. Because the belief from the data are that unless you do those families will be dragged into poverty. And those are probably good assumptions. If you look around the developed world, there's huge income transfers from the rich to families, and some families who are not poor, but who have disabled children, under the fear that there is this reverse causation. That is, that illness, particularly chronic illness, manifests early in life, will decrease contribution to society. Therefore, sick people become poorer. The issue for science, in my mind, is how much in any particular place, in any particular time, or the particular outcome of the gradient is due causation and selection, because that will vary from time to time and place to place and outcome to outcome. But my argument is it'll never be zero, the contribution of selection. And just to give you some reasons why I believe that, this is a complicated chart. It's the relationship between, based on something called the panel study of income dynamics in this country, it's the longest and largest study of the economic experiences of families. And it's also called the 5,000 family study because it started with 5,000 families over 30 years ago. And these are the findings, among the findings. There's only one corner I want you to look at in this distributional surface, and that's D. It's the probability that offspring from the highest 10% families will end up in the highest 10%, and that's about 23%. So about 23% of the children of the highest decile, 23% of the parents in the highest decile stay in the highest decile. 23% of their children stay in the highest decile.
I'll get it.
And about 20% of their, 40% of their children stay in the highest 20%. So 60% of the children of the highest decile in the United States end up below the top 20%.
Now, we don't know why, because in the U.S. we don't have very good long cohort studies. But I would argue, based on what we know from small studies, a lot has to do with health. And I'm going to show you data from the same study that Sir Michael referred you to.
This is the 1958 National Child Development Study from Great Britain, where they've been following this cohort. Now, different people can look at the same data and see different things. I'll only tell you what the general consensus is, probably, unfortunately, among economists. This is the best site, I think, because it summarizes the data. This is the quote. Of all the childhood characteristics captured in the NCDS, parental education, socioeconomic status, the uterine environment, and childhood chronic conditions, the number of chronic conditions is the most important in explaining who is and is not in the labor force at age 42. Controlling for parental SES, controlling for characteristics of gestation, it was chronic illnesses early in a child's life that best predict what happens later in life in terms of the success in the labor force. So if what's happening in Britain is happening in the U.S., and I don't know any reason to suspect it's not, then probably some of that downward mobility is due to health and could contribute to the gradient. What fraction, I don't know, and it would depend on the outcome. But to assume it's nothing or to dismiss it, I think, is probably not appropriate. Okay, what does the gradient apply for the collective discussion over the good society? Because this is, after all, why we do the gradient. It's to try to get people to focus on this question. And this is the WHO commission to which Sir Michael alluded. This is a quote directly from the draft report. People need the basic material requisites for a decent life. They need to have control over their lives, and they need political voice and participation in decision making. This is syllogism applied here. And the syllogism goes something like this. Good societies give people control over their lives, a political voice, and allow participation in decision-making processes. People with control over their lives, a political voice, and who participate in decision-making processes have better health than others. Therefore, good health should be a characteristic of good societies. That's the syllogism. The minor premise here, though, is the problem. I'm going to argue that this minor premise, which says that people with control over their lives, a political voice, and who participate in decision-making have better health than others, is probably an error. Are not a strong assumption. I'm going to argue that those things, that is, having control over your life, a political voice, and allowing participation, while a good thing, don't get me wrong, I'm not going to stand up here and say I'm against those things, I'm very much for them. And would do everything I could to encourage them and allow those to be the definition of a good society. But do they predict health? Let me show you some data. Whoops. I'm having to erase a bit here. Okay. This is the U.S. This is life expectancy. First, from 1933, I have to start with 33 because the U.S. doesn't have data before then. And you can see that England and Wales does quite well compared to Denmark and the U.S. In fact, better than the U.S. and Denmark, but we're actually better than Denmark. Now, is anybody in this room going to argue that we have more autonomy, voice, and participation than Denmark? I don't think so. I don't think that's sufficient. Because if it were, you wouldn't have Denmark below us. And are they necessary? Well, that's Spain, the yellow one. Spain is the remarkable public health story of the 20th century. When anybody wants to tell you about any other place, forget it, just go look in Spain. It's quite remarkable what happened in Spain. You see that line? They started very low, caught us, and surpassed the rest of us. And they did that catching up mainly when Franco was in power. Franco made it an objective of his regime to be able to tell people that you've lost your freedom, you've lost your voice, you've lost your participation, and you're going to live in one hell of a hierarchy because I'm going to make you healthier. That's the payoff. And it happened. So in fact, is it necessary to have those three things to have good health? Uh-uh. Spain did it with quite the opposite. And I want you to look carefully now at those late 1970s, when Spain passed the U.S., Denmark, and the U.K. Was Spain a better society in those years than the three of us? Or anybody would prefer to live in Spain then than any of these three other places? I thought not. Just if you want to see some other places that have the same problem, and Sir Michael showed you some of these data, this is adding Hungary and the Czech Republic, and you can see that when they were under those very heavy-handed regimes, they got healthier very fast. Okay, what are we really after then? Is health really the measure of a society? Nah. I'm going to suggest that some folks in the Netherlands who have been doing this stuff for 15 to 20 years really are after something much better than we epidemiologists deal with. And they call it happy life expectancy. Because after all, it's happiness that we're after, really. And they've done some very interesting work where they do very large surveys of national populations and they ask them, are you satisfied with life? Are you happy? And this whole battery of questions, and they standardize these. And then they look at the fraction of each age group that reports being happy. And then they go back and they weigh life expectancy by how happy those people are in those life scales. And you can see that what we all know is we'd rather be in Denmark. Because while Denmark has the lowest life expectancy of those countries that you see up there, it's the happiest. And the UK, which had, at least for most of that period of time, very high life expectancy, is in fact less happy. And Spain, which had the highest increase in life expectancy, is the least happy. You can tell it from their films. So, you know, are we after the right thing? Sir Michael and I write when we go out and argue with people, you know, do these things because it's good for your health? I'm going to say it's not. In fact, I'm going to say it's risky. Because if you convince people that population health is the standard of a good society, I can tell you what's going to happen. We're going to look for more people who know how to deliver population health fast, and those are not people interested in participation, voice, and all those other good things. Because history suggests that the way to make people healthy fast is to deny them all those things. And to make them healthy by taking away lots of choices. Because I think ultimately people pursue happiness, which is not an identity with health. Thank you. I had to shortcut that, but that's the story.
Well, that was terrific, and it seems to me we've set the agenda for a couple of days of good discussion, not a 5-minute riposte. Let me start in a way at the end. When you put up that quote saying WHO, I recognized those words because I wrote them. They were from the interim statement of the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, so they're really rather familiar. One of the problems, and you alluded to this, is that, as we know well, people approach data more, they use data more as missiles or weapons to throw at others, I mean, to support a position, than they do to derive science. So that somebody who thinks, I mean, I've seen it, that is marital status protective? If you're an economist, you think no. Sick people don't get married, or they, you know, and if you're a social causationist, you find marital status to be protective. And when I first encountered these economists, the people like Chris Paxson and so on, it reminded me of the nature-nurture debates. You know, I thought this is endless. You know, in nature-nurture, people decide fairly early on in their scientific life which side of that debate they're on, and it goes on forever. And I said to them in some exasperation that, you know, they kept thinking of reasons why it could all be selection or endogenous, as the economists call it. And I said, what a futile exercise this is. Why on earth would you want to spend your whole life showing that sick people are sick? I mean, there may be some intervening variable like social status or employment or something, but essentially the argument is sick people find themselves in unfortunate positions and sick people get sick. So people like Marmot mistakenly believe unfortunate positions lead to illness, when really the fundamental truth is that sickness is correlated with sickness. And it seems to me such a futile enterprise. Now, I'm part of the same, and as you say, that we're really on the same side here. We're on the same side. We come to it because we want to make the world a better place. So we look at that evidence and we find that the evidence supports our position. Now, in fact, colleagues of mine, so can health selection play a role? Absolutely. Of course it can play a role. I mean, if you take away somebody's arm, he can't be a builder's laborer anymore if that was the only job he could do. But health selection must play a role. How important is it to the social gradient? Well, colleagues of mine have actually looked at that. And what they find, generally speaking, is if you look at within generation mobility, not between generation, what they find is that people who are upwardly mobile have better health than the class they left, but worse health than the class of destination. People who are downwardly mobile have worse health than the class they left, but better health than the class of destination. The effect of health-related social mobility is to make the gradient shallower. The gradient isn't caused by health-related social mobility, it's hidden by it. It's actually shallower as a result of that. So they've actually quantitated these two effects rather than to say it is or it isn't. They've quantitated the two effects, and the social causation one is stronger in causing the social gradient. I mean, it's interesting you chose Denmark. Denmark is the outlier of the Nordic countries. We know that. All over Europe, people are saying, why do Danish women have the lowest life expectancy in Europe? It's a massive puzzle. Nobody's got a handle on it. Had you chosen Sweden, it wouldn't have fitted with your counter-argument. Denmark is the outlier. We really don't get Denmark. And it's part of a general point that I wrote those words, but I don't believe autonomy and political voice are the only drivers of the health status of a population. And my narrative of what happened in Central and Eastern Europe is post-war, what the communist regimes did was they provided jobs, they provided education, they provided housing. They really improved things, and health got better as a result of what the communist regimes did. And then what happened, and a Czech colleague of mine said, I can date it. It was about 1963 when we got West German television in Czechoslovakia. And we found out what was going on in the rest of Europe. And it was great for the first 15 or 20 years because we had jobs and we had housing, we had education, and nobody died of malnutrition. And then we figured out what the West Germans were getting, and that led directly to the Prague Spring of 1968, and that led directly to the Russian tanks. And what happened to life expectancy? Starting in 1970, more or less the date of the Prague Spring and the Russian invasion, life expectancy stagnated throughout the Central and Eastern European countries, throughout the Soviet Union. And what better explanation would you find than, in fact, those socialist economies were not delivering to people's needs? They were in the first 20 years. The basic needs of housing and of education, of shelter, of care for older people, of jobs. But then it stopped, and people wanted more, and they weren't getting it. And that actually led to the collapse of those regimes. Now, what's happened in the other countries is health has started to improve. In the Soviet Union and the former Soviet Union, it didn't, because it really collapsed. And I don't think you could argue that health, ill health, led to that collapse. I really think it's the lack of structures, the huge increase in inequality. The Gini coefficient went from being below what we're used to seeing in Western countries to much higher. It looks like Latin America now. Russia's gone on a Latin American course. So to take, you know, a few graphs in a particular time, Tim Besley has studied this, the economist at the LSE, has actually studied, he sent me this paper, he was a bit contrite about it all, but he actually studied democracy and shows democracy is good for health, and taking all the countries from which you could get data, not a few select countries that make a particular point. And I would say the same about the social gradient. Some historians said to me, that the social gradient, you do not see it always and everywhere. Therefore, you shouldn't treat it as some sort of social or biological law. And they saw me smiling. Why are you smiling? Why are you happy about that? Well, I said, that's great. If it was some sort of inevitable social biological law, there'd be nothing we could do about it. But the fact that you can find examples, now you've found examples from California. I can show you that in Mali and in India and in Brazil and in Kenya, we see a social gradient in infant mortality and we see a social gradient in under five mortality. The bottom quintile are worse than the second bottom quintile. So the fact that you can find an example where it's not true is great, just terrific. Means we don't have to accept it as always and everywhere. Now, it's very interesting to know why you get that exception in California. Very interesting. But I can tell you it's a social gradient in Mali, and it's a social gradient in Brazil, and it's a social gradient in India, and in virtually every country where we've got demographic and health surveys, it's a social gradient. The bottom quintile are worse off than the quintile above them. So the exceptions are interesting, but so is the rule. And, you know, the fact that in US figures, the difference between the $100,000 and the $200,000 income was rather small. Yeah, okay, fine. I mean, we've got data from England and Wales where we've got 20, we've got, I don't know how you say that, five percenters, what, aisles, something, with 20 lots anyway, by measures of deprivation by area. And it's remarkably graded. The difference between the median and the top one is nearly as big as the difference between the median and the bottom for mortality and life expectancy. So the fact that it's not always and everywhere the same, I take that as very positive. And I think I'll finish the general point about your general point about skepticism, and in a way unpicking the hidden motivations, I think is terribly important. And you know, you and I are in 100% agreement that we proceed much better and on much firmer ground by having critical debates, not just accepting as some sort of truism what we've found. And I'm guilty of selective citation as well. Of course I am. I can tell a narrative, and I've got data about the importance of control. I've got data like citing Tim Besley's data on democracy and political participation that actually support my argument. So I would defend those, you called it WHO, but the words that Michael Marmot wrote, that syllogism, I would defend it with evidence, even though I'm really writing from a prejudice.
Well, I'm speaking from a prejudice, but I think I will just wave my time back to the class of questions, because I really can't disagree with it.
So, Ray, can I ask you what's so special about California, then?
Well, it's I can give you the short story. I mean, we don't
know. Hypotheses.
Yeah, it's really I think what's going on is it's a very selective migration we have in California, very healthy people and their offspring. But I don't take that to be make it an exception, because most places in the world are experiencing migration. Some places, though, where there are migrants, you still find the migrants at the bottom, and that tells you something about how you can argue that they either selected poor people to migrate, or that the places to which they're migrating are offering them something that they didn't get what they were expecting. So I think that's something for the sociologists and the social psychologists to study. But I think in California, what you see is the influence of migration.
Levels, which is an inflammatory protein, a risk factor for Parkinson's. But I'm wondering, my question is, if you were to carry it further back, anyone who has had children will tell you that it's sometime between the age of 3 and 5, the perceptions of, that's not fair, set in. And if a child grows, even into pre-adolescence, convinced that life is not fair, is that in and of itself going to be a, didn't show up in adolescence as markers of inequality, and does that set the course in the person believing that inequality is inherent and therefore being condemned to a life of the health consequences of inequality from a very young age? Do you think it's such in that early?
Well, very interesting question. I mean, firstly, let me just say a word about the biological markers. With my economist colleagues at UCL in London, I have to say, a breakthrough. They say for the first time ever, students in economics at UCL are taught that the relationship between health and socioeconomic position may be two-way. So they acknowledge that the direction may go both ways. So that's a major breakthrough. Right. And one of the interesting parts of the argument is they tend to treat the body as a black box. But when they're really rather impressed by the biological mechanisms, that that's a different order of discussion. That's really interesting, the fact that you can make a plausible biological argument. Now, full disclosure, to my horror, one of the economists looked at our data and showed that C-reactive protein levels predicted subsequently whether people would stay in the workforce. So that's in the interest of full disclosure, but I was most upset. But coming back then to your question about this issue of fairness, a very interesting one, and I don't have a real answer. But Robert Frank, who's written lots of books about the whole issue of inequality, and he wrote one called Choosing the Right Pond, but the one that I'm thinking about is Luxury Fever. And he implies that we're all programmed to be intolerant of unfairness. This fair, unfair business, and in fact, I was just talking with somebody else about it today, that I think it clearly is programmed in, because our kids all claim about unfairness. But Robert Frank implies, and he appeals to the evolutionary psychologists, as well as to these ultimatum bargaining games that you must be familiar with, that people are intolerant of unfairness. And you know the ultimatum bargaining games, that here's $10, we'll split it up. The first player says how much they'll take, and the second player says whether the game can go ahead. And it turns out, you know, over lots of trials, that it works out at $6.60 versus $3.40 or something like that. That, in other words, if the distribution is more unequal than that, the second player will say, no, I'd rather do without the money than have you, you rotten skunk, ending up with all that stuff.
That's what children pick up on the
playground. Robert Frank's implying that, I mean, there must be variations in the degree to which we take that into adulthood, but he's implying we're all intolerant of that unfairness. And I'm trying to use that argument politically, because one of my arguments to get governments to take it seriously, we have a poll that I'm pointing to where in Britain, 80% of the population will affirm a position that it's wrong for poor people to have worse health, for example, and there are a variety of things like that. And in fact, I think we can make an argument that a fair swathe of the population is intolerant of unfairness. Mm. Now, whether your interesting question is right or not, I don't know, whether those who are more intolerant of it or more conscious of it have worse health than others, I'm not sure.
That social grade by saying I have more, I'm helping you, matter what, whether how positive or how benevolent those interests are in that act of helping someone out, you end up reaffirming that social gradient to them. Does that make things worse, better?
I was at a philosophy seminar with Amartya Sen, who's visiting Stanford at the moment, and this seminar ranged from the Bhagavad Gita to John Rawls and Maimonides. And somebody quoted Maimonides, 8 levels of charity. And I'm not enough of a scholar or don't have a good enough memory to remember what all 8 levels were, but the highest level of it, I mean, the lowest level is where you as the giver, identified as the benevolent giver, go and give something to the poor disadvantaged person. That's the lowest level of charity. The highest level of charity, it goes through being anonymous and so on, is actually creating the conditions where the person doesn't need handouts at all. So I would say giving is better than not giving, but it doesn't bear much comparison with actually creating the conditions where people don't need handouts. And don't ask me to quote the Bhagavad Gita, but I could...
This will have to be the last question.
So now I'm asking you a question. Yes. So when you showed that very complex slide about the next generation, you used wealth. You used income, but not wealth.
Right.
Does that translate well?
Empirically, it's hard to tell because we don't have those kinds of data. My suspicion is it doesn't work as well. That's why there are actual legal instruments to create foundations, that wealthy people create foundations for their children with health problems. But what happens is that those kids oftentimes do fall out of the very top because those little sort of foundations allow you to stay certainly well above poverty, but they don't typically allow you to stay at the top.
I'd like to thank both of our speakers for an extraordinary debate.